For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week, Maud Roll urges us to see sight loss differently in her new book, Blind Spot. Christina Lusick-Berger introduces us to The Woman at the Gates, the story of how Ukrainian resistance fighters tried to save their country from both Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany during World War II. And founder of the Happiness Institute, Mike Viking, has some tips to brighten up the long winter nights. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Maud Roll is a blind writer and journalist living in London. In her new book, Blind Spot, she takes readers on a whirlwind tour of history, focusing on blind pioneers and her own experience of sight loss to debunk myths and challenge the world to see differently. Maud, welcome to Read On.
Hi, Red. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's such a pleasure to be here.
The book is split into four sections, and it begins with the story of your own sight loss.
That's right. Yeah, so I was fully sighted for the first 19 years of my life. I didn't really know anything about blindness. I didn't know any blind people. So going blind myself was really a bolt out of the blue. And it happened right at the end of my gap year when I was traveling in South Korea. Well, I'm glad it happened at the end and not at the start. That would have been a very different story. But I came home. I was seen at Moorfields Eye Hospital, where I was diagnosed with a very rare degenerative eye condition. And it kind of helped that at that stage in my life, I had the next few years of my life planned out quite well. So I was going to university. I had a place already. So blindness just sort of had to fit around the plans I already had because I didn't want to give up any of those things. So I've progressively lost sight over the last 6 years since that point. And I think it really highlighted for me that sight loss is something that can be really traumatic and feel really tragic for people that it happens to out of nowhere. But we kind of create a lot of the conditions that make it that way because we're so poorly educated on what blindness actually is, how it can manifest itself, like how it can affect you in loads of ways that don't seem immediately obvious if you don't know very much about it. And we don't know about blind people from history, blind accomplishments. We don't know any of these things that could really empower blind people and make them not so terrified of losing their sight. Because the fact is, the chances of you experiencing sight loss get much higher the older you get. Do we not all essentially want to live long lives? It seems crazy to keep blindness as something that's really terrifying when we have so much power to shine a light on it and explore what it actually is and how it can do amazing things in the world and how it's not this terrifying specter that looms over all our lives effectively. I think if you get up into your 80s and 90s, it's like one in two people will experience sight loss. So we're not talking a tiny, tiny chance of this happening to you.
Exactly. It is not that other. It is a perfectly normal part of human life. And yet that lack of understanding, well, that's what really forms the focus of the first part of your book and how we need greater visibility of what it means to lose your sight and greater education.
Absolutely. This is a real passion of mine, preaching on the power of education. I really do just think ignorance is so much part of basically all the problems blind people face. I really feel that all the problems I face as a blind person are not because of blindness itself, but just because people don't understand it. And that ignorance begets inaction, it begets prejudice and hate crimes in some instances. So it's not a neutral position to take to be uneducated about these things. You're actively creating harm in people's lives and making life really hard for a whole community who no one's chosen to be blind. It's just a thing that happens. As we've said, it's perfectly natural. Like, disabled people have always existed and it is just part of being human. Ignorance really does create a situation where people are sort of punished for being disabled. So education is a really important part of tackling that ignorance. So the first chapter of my book, as you've said, the theme is visibility. So I talk about things like how not having access to role models who have also encountered blindness deprives people of these really important figures in our lives who can really change our lives. I mean, loads of people have stories about heroes who have absolutely shaped what they've gone on to do. They show us what we ourselves are capable of. They can do amazing things in our lives. And not being given access to blind role models from history is really having an impact on the community. Blind people suffer terribly from mental health problems. Something like 4 in 10 people attending low vision clinics have clinical depression. Really shockingly high numbers of people who suffer with their mental health. And I really think that increased visibility can help tackle some of those problems. And the flip side of that is not just that we're not being given access to people from history who can show us that blindness doesn't have to be this terrible, terrible thing. You can go on to do incredible things, because that is absolutely true. And there are loads of examples to show it. But the flip side is that there's rampant misrepresentation in pop culture as well. So we're sort of getting the opposite effect, where instead of showcasing brilliant blind people, we're being shown ridiculous caricatures of blindness that are really uninformed. You either get blindness being painted as something completely tragic, or as this kind of comedic, blind people are really stupid and idiotic and just bump into things all the time. These are real people. I almost don't understand how people creating these blind characters that are so terribly, terribly uninformed and genuinely quite offensive don't remember that blind people are real, and you might actually upset people when you do that. I laugh, but it's actually quite upsetting. But I think misrepresentation is another really important part of the problem, and education again can help tackle that by showing people what blindness actually is and ensuring that people will represent it a bit more accurately, because the power of a good representation can be really powerful.
Yes, those lazy stereotypes of stricken victim or comedic person walking into a lamppost are incredibly negative. And I've been blind for, well, much longer than you've been alive. And yet you gave me a couple of examples of blind people who have achieved incredible things in history who I'd never heard of, like Jack Metcalfe.
Yes, he was one of the first civil engineers in the country. He built roads up in the north of England, many of which still exist. He also pioneered a way to get road to span marshland by balancing it on springy heather and gorse and plants that are native to that region. But yeah, one of the first civil engineers in the country, I think, is an amazing accomplishment. And he was blind, so there really are no limits.
And one of the most productive mathematicians of all time, Leonid Euler.
Yes, Euler. He went blind about halfway through his life, and after that wrote even more than he had before. I think when he went blind, he literally said, "Now I will have fewer distractions." And his prolificacy really reached new heights. After he died, it took the St. Petersburg Academy about 50 years to publish all of his unpublished work.
And the next section of your book is about accessibility. You argue that it has an image problem.
Yeah, I think that part of the problem is that as a society, we tend to see accessibility as this add-on, this extra bit of effort you tack on at the end of a project that's already finished, and that it's going to serve a tiny minority of users, generally the disabled community. And people generally tend to think of that community as negligible in number or in worth in terms of the product they're selling. So as a result, we don't put that much effort into it. It's never really thought of as part of the intrinsic design. And I do essentially think this is an image problem, because we think that accessibility doesn't affect the majority. We think that it doesn't matter for everyone, and it does. And there are loads of examples you can look at to show why accessibility has a far more wide-reaching impact than most people tend to think. There are loads of benefits to exploring it. So one example I use in the book is that of OCR, optical character recognition, which has quite an old history. I think it originally dates back to around the First World War, but it wasn't especially well developed until the 70s, when someone called Ray Kurzweil in the States took it on and wanted to use it to develop a way for books to be read aloud to the blind. That was his goal. And so he developed OCR from its kind of mechanical origins and really, really boosted its impact. And today, OCR affects almost every life on the planet. I mean, it's how we get automatic number plate recognition, how we have searchable PDFs. Every book digitized by Project Gutenberg that uses OCR technology. Automatic translation, where you can type something in one language and have it immediately translated into another, or take a picture of something and have it translated into another language. All of that is using OCR technology. And that was literally developed out of trying to get technology to work for the blind. And the fact is that developing accessibility for the blind naturally calls for us to think of ways of doing things without our eyes, which is really important because humans have other senses. And I think we tend to almost forget that we do, in the sense that because sight is our primary sense, we use it for everything and our default is to use it, when actually there are really important ways we can be using our other senses that we tend to ignore. So another example I talk about in my book is in the world of astrophysics. An amazing blind astrophysicist called Wanda Diaz-Merced, she developed a way to sonify astrophysical data. And when she was testing this software, she gave sighted astrophysicists sets of data, some of which were in audio, some of which were visual only, and some of which combined the modalities. And she found that using audio helped everyone's ability to detect black holes, which was what that test was showing. So the fact is, we've been holding ourselves back by only using sight-based methods of observation in science. And there are loads of ways in which we can be using our other senses alongside sight and in some cases instead of sight, to do amazing things and innovate and invent new things and just generally learn more about the world around us. And us all exploring it helps everyone. It helps the entire human race advance and develop in terms of intellectual progress and just social justice. And I think both of those things are really important.
And I think one of the areas that it really made me think about as well was the arts, culture, have almost become synonymous with being the visual arts and visual culture. And in the third section of your book, you actually come on to address exactly that problem, that we associate art and beauty just with what we can see. And that really is actively cutting blind people out of the equation.
Absolutely. The fact that we think of so much art as visual means that our attempts to make it accessible are really lacking. So the example I use at the start of that chapter is that if you go to the National Portrait Gallery, they have a collection of something like 215,000 portraits, and they have audio description for 150 of them, which is about 0.01% of their collection. That's not good enough. And it also calls us to question like why art is important and why not giving blind people access to it matters. I talk at length about why art is really important, and it is essentially part of being human. We are the only species that creates art. It takes so many skills that only humans have. And so to deprive a community of access to art is essentially dehumanizing, because it is part of who we are as a species. I also think that the modern idea that art is something that you look at and not engage with using your other senses actually has more sinister origins than most of us tend to think. We tend to think it's about protection and conservation. You know, you can't touch a painting because you'll damage it and eventually it won't be able to be on display because we can't protect it. But it's not just about that. It's actually tied up in loads of 18th century shifts in gender, race and class politics. And I think the fact that we don't know about those origins is quite concerning, because it means we perpetuate these systems that have quite sinister roots without realizing that we're doing that. Okay, so the gender politics side of it would be that there were shifts in how the senses were perceived, in that men became associated with the higher senses of sight and hearing, and women were associated with the lower senses of smell and taste and touch, which were quite domestic or bodily senses. So before these shifts came along, touching things in museums was absolutely part and parcel of the museum experience. One cultural historian said that going to a museum and not being able to touch all the artifacts would be like being invited to a dinner party and not being allowed to eat the food. It was absolutely just what you did in a museum. That was how you engaged with artifacts and pieces of history. And so when the middle class came along and they had wealth to protect and they were worried about the masses being all dirty and touching everything, these things started to change, and it became more of a norm for people to not touch things, to look at them from afar. And I mean, nowadays there are barriers you have to stand behind. We are limiting the ways in which we can engage with art, ways that can be really, really meaningful. And we've decided to cut ourselves off from loads of that. And for blind people, where we can't necessarily rely on just being able to use a visual way of engagement with art, that makes things really difficult. And I really do think that is essentially dehumanizing.
And as you point out, it's not as if there are not and have not in the past been plenty of blind artists.
Exactly, yes. Ultimately, what I think is most ironic is that what art is essentially telling us is the beauty of seeing differently. Great art is all about seeing differently, which is essentially what blindness is. If we look at all the most beloved artists throughout history, they are showing us different windows into types of blindness. If you think about the Impressionists with their blurry, broken up areas of colour, I mean, that is literally what some blind people see. My favourite example that I always go to is J.M.W. Turner, who famously used pigments that faded even within his own lifetime. He took really poor care of his canvases, so lots of them are damaged with kind of mould. And so when we look at these paintings today, which are so beloved, we're looking at them through a lens of blindness. And so what art should be teaching us is to embrace diverse ways of seeing, and yet instead we're using it in systems that discriminate against the blind, which I think I just really would like people to recognize that irony, because great art really should be teaching us a very different lesson instead of being pulled into the mechanisms of discrimination.
And you actually illustrate the accomplishment of some contemporary blind artists by providing postcards with the physical copy of Blindspot.
Yeah, so people who order the book will also receive 4 postcards, 2 from each of the blind artists I interviewed for chapter 3. So one is Keith Salmon, who works up in Scotland. He paints semi-abstract landscapes. He's incredibly talented. His work is beautiful. Yep, so we've included 2 of his works and also 2 by an artist called Park Hwan, who works in South Korea. He essentially lost all of his eyesight all at once in a car accident. And after that, had to essentially learn how to become an artist all over again because he couldn't paint the way he used to because that relied so much on his eyes. So now he creates 3-dimensional works and applies paint using his fingers. So he'll essentially draw with thread on a canvas so he can feel where he's designed the sketch. And then he'll apply paint with his fingertips. But it's not just that he had to develop new physical techniques of creating art. It's that his whole mentality about art changed and why art matters and why it's important. It was so moving to speak with him, and what he said is really important for people to read and to know about art and blindness and how blind people aren't separate from something that is visual or even something that we perceive as visual. Blindness has always been part of human history, and it's as much part of art as any other community.
Certainly one of the things that comes out throughout the book is just how innovative so many blind people are. We are born problem solvers because we have to be.
Absolutely. The thing about moving through a world which isn't designed with you in mind is that, as you say, we constantly have to solve problems. And the way we solve problems is inherently just quite creative. We have to think outside the box. And the fact is that you don't have to be blind to learn from blind creative problem solving. Most people live inside that box, which is just, you know, having good sight. And so anyone who can think outside that box should be welcomed into any community which fosters innovation. Blindness can really be a strength in almost every field. And I really think we should be embracing that rather than hiding blind people away in the shadows and not welcoming them into these places of knowledge and learning, because blindness really can bring something to the table.
You and I both live in London, which, though it is better than many places in the world, can be a very frustrating place for a blind or partially sighted person to live. But there are places that get it more right than others. And one of those is Japan.
Yes. So I did Japanese as my university degree. I lived there for a year as my year abroad. For my research for chapter 2 on accessibility, I spoke to Mona Minkara, who won the Holman Prize a few years ago, and as part of that project, visited 5 cities and was able to compare different ways in which these cities were accessible to the blind. And when I asked which was the best and which was the worst at accessibility, sadly, London came last and Tokyo came first. So she talked me through the different ways in which Tokyo was made really accessible. And it was essentially just that sound had been considered as an intrinsic part of the design. It wasn't just kind of tacked on just for the blind. It was for everyone. And it is helpful for everyone. The fact is that when an environment is made accessible, it makes it more aesthetic and just a better experience for everyone. So things like in Tokyo tube stations, there's birdsong to indicate the exits. There's different jingles for all of the different trains. There's the sound of running water near the bathroom. So you don't necessarily have to be looking for signs. You can follow your ears. And it just means that for blind people, you can navigate independently and safely. But then for everyone, you just have a more immersive and useful experience of a place. You're not just using your eyes. You can use other senses at the same time. And it's just the blending of all that different sensory intel that makes the environment so successfully accessible and pleasant for everyone. And we talked a lot about the mental health implications of places not being accessible. The fact that when somewhere you live or somewhere you go on holiday to, or just kind of any physical place, makes it impossible for you to be safe and independent at the same time. You literally just have to pick one. It's either I can guess when it's safe to cross this road and risk my life, or I can ask someone for help, which for many people can feel humiliating. It can feel like I don't want to be in a position of being forced to ask for help, but this city has made it that I have to, because I can't physically do this independently without being able to see, which is something the city can absolutely fix. This isn't a situation that needs to exist. But yeah, so Mona had the chance to explore these different cities and their different takes on accessibility for the Holman Prize, which is run by the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And I was lucky enough to be a Holman Prize winner this year, which is such an honor, and I'm so grateful to them for it. And so they are funding me to go back to Japan for a year and travel around some of its most remote parts and write a book about my travels, which I will hopefully be setting off for in April, but it's all kind of visa dependent. And I'm not going to lie, the new coronavirus variants are quite stressful to factor into my plans, but it's very much in the spirit of James Holman, who the Holman Prize is named after, who was an amazing Georgian early Victorian explorer. He circumnavigated the globe. He was completely blind. He's my ultimate dream dinner party guest from history, just an incredible historical figure who sadly we sort of forgot to keep learning about in schools and just generally in our cultural memory, but he absolutely deserves to be rehabilitated. And I cannot recommend Jason Roberts' biography of him, A Sense of the World, enough. It's a fantastic book and I really recommend people go and read it.
It, of course, is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, where hopefully it will be joined by Blind Spot soon. I know that you're hoping that an audiobook version is going to be recorded before you go to Japan.
Yes, so at the moment there's a print copy and an ebook copy that are available now. The audio version, me and my publishers are absolutely committed to making that happen, and it will happen. And a copy of Blindspot is also being transcribed into Braille, but I am sorry that we couldn't quite get them all out at the same time, but I promise that it will be accessible in as many ways as we can make possible. So stay tuned. There will be an audio version.
I know there will be. In the meantime, if people like me want to educate those around me by giving somebody a paperback copy, how can I get it?
So the best way to do that is to buy it through the 404 Inc. website. That way you're supporting independent publishing, so that would be great. Get paperback versions for sighted people in your life who you want to know more about blindness. The afterword of my book, for example, lists a whole load of ways that sighted people can change their behavior in really easy everyday ways just to be a bit more tolerant and kinder towards the blind community. But ultimately, I really do think this book is for everyone. I think if you're sighted, you're going to learn a lot and you're hopefully going to modify your behavior. But this book really helped me find my blind pride. Writing it was an amazing experience and it really transformed how I felt about myself and being blind myself. And I did see the other day on a Facebook community for blind people that I'm a member of, someone had just posted, "Does it get any better?" And they were talking about how they had really crippling anxiety because of vision loss. And I remember how traumatic it is to lose your sight. And I do want people who are listening who are maybe still in that stage where they feel it's quite traumatic and they don't know what they're doing or they're struggling with their mental health, that it does get better. And there is so much information out there that can really empower you. And I really hope that Blindspot will contain some of that and that it can help you in some way.
Maud, it has been an absolute pleasure to meet you and to read your book. Hopefully we'll speak again before you head off to Tokyo. But if not, I look forward to inviting you back onto the show to talk about your second book.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
And a reminder, Maud Roll's book, Blind Spot, is available from 404 Inc., which is I-N-K, and her surname is spelt R-O-W-E-L-L. And Maud will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Hey, I'm Holly.
And I'm Paulina.
We're hosts of The Happy Hour, a new show joining the RNIB Connect radio family.
Expect a mix of great music,
tips and advice for keeping well.
And of course, each episode, a guest will join us for a candid conversation around well-being and sight loss.
And I get scared like anybody else and I have bad eye days. And in other days, it's my magic sauce.
And to all of you, good luck. You can do it. Sending you all a big virtual hug.
The Happy Hour. Catch it on RNIB Connect Radio every Monday at 1 p.m,
Thursday at 6 p.m,
and once again Sunday at 10 a.m.
with new episodes every other week. See you there.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we'll hear from an expert in happiness about how to bring a little light into the long dark winter. But before that, Christina Lusick-Berger's historical novels have received much acclaim. Her latest book, The Woman at the Gates, tells the story of Antonia and the resistance movement against the invasion of Ukraine by both Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany during World War II. Along with her compatriots Viktor, Ivan and Pavlov, Antonia must decide whether to stay and fight or to save her sister when she's sent to a concentration camp. part historical fiction, part romance, part family drama, The Woman at the Gates is a moving story of making difficult choices in impossible circumstances. Christina joined Hannah Taus down the line from her home in Austria.
Christina Lusig-Berger, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much.
Can we start off by you just giving us a bit of an introduction to The Woman at the Gates?
Sure. So back in the early 90s, my grandmother, who lived with us, so it was my father's mother, she was a writer and a poet and a musician. And when she was dying, I went to visit her in hospital. And we were talking about her life, and she asked me to tell her story. And the way that she said it in Ukrainian, I understood that she wanted me to translate her works from Ukrainian into English. And I thought, that is going to be one daunting task. I was just beginning to learn that I was interested in writing, that I really loved the craft and was pursuing either a journalism degree where I thought I could make money at writing or literature. And when she said that, I thought, wow, that would take up my entire life, because she was very prolific. She would write until, 3 o'clock in the morning. At times I would hear her typewriter clacking away. And then years later, I thought, I gotta actually do something with this. And I was watching a documentary and I kind of fell asleep, and I had a visit from my grandmother in my dream. And when I woke up, I realized that it wasn't her works that she wanted translated. She wanted her story told. And I told my mother this, and she said, that's a great idea. At the time, women's memoirs were very, very hot. And she said, why don't you go and talk to your other grandmother and find out what her stories are and start recording the family's stories? And that's exactly what I did. And it took me, I would say, approximately 3 years to get it all down. And I had a lot of recordings, and I had extended it to my mother's aunts and uncles and my godmother. And I had all of this material, but I didn't understand a thing. I didn't understand the political aspects of it. What I did know, and what I did end up understanding, was that I didn't know my family. And it was shocking to me that even my father, under the same roof, the stories that he told me, I was like, oh, they were amazing. And I thought, I don't even know where people got their strengths for this. And that's how it started. So I had an abundance of material and I didn't know where to start with it. So I decided to leave. I went to Europe and I traveled by myself. I just felt like I was too naive, too cushioned to be able to write this story. In the end, I was right. I was too young. I couldn't understand this, but what I did do was I threw myself into learning about World War II. I did have to figure out how I was going to get my family's story into one novel. I described this process like taking a pot of red-hot borscht and trying to extract all of the individual ingredients. And then trying to make it something that is digestible again, but not only digestible, it's sellable. And that was the hardest part about this entire book. I ended up taking a lot of those stories, a lot of the anecdotes, a lot of the research, and making composites. And I think in the end, that became the most fun part. But I'll tell you, at the beginning, writing The Woman at the Gates was a tremendously daunting task for me. And very cathartic. By the time I was finished, I realized that I had kept my promise to my grandmother.
It's great to see some fictional literature on the role of Ukraine during the Second World War. I mean, they were really stuck between a rock and a hard place, desperate to escape Soviet Russian occupation on the one hand, but only able to do so through collaborating with Germany. How difficult was it to try and convey the sense that there were really no good choices to be made at the time?
I think that is the crux of the moral dilemma in this story. Which of the two evils are you going to work with? Because the Ukrainians were, unfortunately, they had so much infighting going on between the different factions. Each of the factions wanted to free Ukraine and rule it, and all of them had a different idea of how to do this. first of all, the Russians, the Poles, the Hungarians had done a very, very good job of splitting up the country, of dividing it from the very beginning, where they were not able to come together and work together, right? So all of them had these different ideas and different approaches to a democracy, or some of them were impressed by Mussolini, for example. So my characters are motivated by the need to be free, by the need to save their heritage, their language, their identities, and trying to figure out who is the least likely to take that away from them. One of my family members explained it really, really well. They said, if you took a look at the Germans and you took a look at the Russians, the culture, the language, the ideologies of the Russians were so similar that we knew that if Russia ended up ruling us, we would completely lose ourselves. The Germans, they didn't use Cyrillic. They had different religion. They had a totally different language, totally different culture. So their fear of losing their identity was less with the Germans than they were with the Russians. And we all know, if you go to Ukraine today, the majority of the people there can only speak Russian. And it's like trying to untwine the roots of two trees that have been growing together for, say, roughly 80, 90 years. You can't do it. That was what they had fought for. And they believed that Germany would be a better ally than Russia in that regard.
It's interesting that Antonia, your heroine, is torn between doing what's right for her country and what's right for her family.
Yeah.
She's got this exceptionally strong moral sense of duty. Yet at the time, survival depended on a certain degree of ruthlessness. How did you go about making sure that she came across as sympathetic to the reader?
Oh, by making her real through her flaws, but also through her passion, through Ivan finally finding her soft spot, or her sister Lena knowing where her soft spots were. Beneath that hardcore nationalism, she loves very desperately. She loves so desperately that her entire flaw is that she doesn't really take care of herself. She puts everybody before her, her country, her family, and even Ivan in the end. She's willing to take it all for them. And it ruins her psychologically at the end. She's suffering at the end. She's suffering from melancholy, which is what my great aunt really was suffering from. She was depressed towards the end. She was traumatized. And back then, you know, nobody really understood PTSD.
So Antonia, as you said, is partially based on your great aunt. And I know she's mixed in with some other family members as well. And there are other characters in the book who also come from your background.
Yeah.
Which character or family member would you have liked to have met most?
My great aunt. Absolutely. Ever since my father told me her story, I've always felt this affinity for her. I think the other person, however, that I really wanted to do justice to in this novel, and this is one of the reasons that I made Antonia a composite of not just the Antonina I thought I might know, but also my paternal grandmother, Olena. I combined them because I realized had I taken the time to ask, to get to know my grandmother when she was alive, I would have found that she was not as soft and soft-spoken and easily frightened as I had believed her to be. She was a very genteel woman. And there is a scene in the book where Lena marches up to the potato farmers on the way to Rosenheim, and she's the one who demands that they get work. She's the one who says, I'm going to try and speak German now. And she's the one who kind of turns around and starts taking care of Antonia. I didn't plan that scene. It just came out as I was writing. And I thought, wow, Lena, congratulations. And that's the first time where I felt, yeah, that was my grandmother.
You have Katie Villa narrating the book. Did you have any involvement with choosing her?
What they do, and I absolutely love this process, is they will send us the narrator's examples for each of the characterizations. What has been very helpful for audiobook narrators is to kind of give them a composite of actors that you could imagine playing those characters. or even adding some sort of characterizations or adjectives or giving a little bit of background, whatever it is. But giving them these hints helps them a lot in formulating the voices.
It was Konstantin who evoked the memory of apricots. A memory so strong, the air suddenly bloomed with the golden, sun-warmed scent. Antonia pulled her nephew closer to her, like a cushion against the impact, and dropped the children's picture book flat on her lap. She remembered the carelessness of that sweet, perfumed juice running down her chin, the feel of her lover's finger catching that drop and putting it to her lips. And she remembered the apricots that had sustained her sister's family on a horrible journey into darkness.
Katie Villa, narrating The Woman at the Gates, written by my guest, Christina Lusick-Berger.
The other thing that I was involved in is to record all of the words in Ukrainian, Russian, German, and the producers came back and said, that was so helpful. It's just a lot easier that way.
The book also contains various maps about how the borders were shifting. Mm-hmm. And you've got two lovely pictures at the back. Could you describe those pictures?
Yeah. So my grandfather was an artist and he studied in Paris with the post-impressionists. And he was very renowned in Western Ukraine for his depiction of Carpathian folklore. And there were a few canvases that survived that he actually took from Ukraine to America with him. And one of those canvases is a painting of a hutsulka, which is a mountain woman in traditional dress. And she's standing next to a horse. And across the road is a Cossack dressed in his normal garb, you know, with kind of sheepskin hat and a cape. And his horse is a little bit raised and it's a wedding. And there's a lot of activity in this painting with the father of the bride with the horse and little boys running around with their stick horses. And you just see there's a lot of activity happening in here. And I have always loved that painting. And when I got married, I asked my father to create the wedding invitations. And I said, could you do something in the direction of this Hutsulka and Cossack painting? But I'd like it to be in black and white. So my father made a composite of this, except that the couple is very close together. So I took that. And when I was writing this book, somehow the idea of making Antonia the Hutsulka and Ivan the Cossack from this painting came up. And I absolutely loved it. And it became kind of a symbol throughout the novel for the two of them. Because one of the first things that we see is that her first lover in the book is Victor. And he has a miniature painting of her in a locket, which is also based on one of my grandfather's paintings. And I thought I can keep these symbols throughout the book. So at the very end, when Ivan is at the exhibition in America, he sees this black and white composite as well. And it's about things that have been lost and found again and things that have meaning to us that are lost and found again.
Christina Lusick-Berger, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us a fascinating insight into a part of European history that I think a lot of people really have no idea about. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope you will come back and join us when your next book is published.
Yeah, I hope so too, Anna. Thank you so much.
The Woman at the Gates by Christina Lusick-Berger is available in audio commercially.
Thanks, Hannah. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we share the books of Maud Rowell's life, hygge is the Danish word for conviviality and conveys a sense of warmth, togetherness and well-being. Despite having even longer, wetter winters than the UK, the Danes still regularly top the lists of happiest nations. Connect Radio presenter Paulina Kutcherou was keen to find out why.
Lighting is not just about candles. Danes are obsessed by lighting in general. I once spent 2 hours walking around Rome with my girlfriend at the time to find a restaurant that had hyggelig lighting. Danes select lamps carefully and place them strategically to create soothing pools of light. It is an art form, a science, and an industry. Some of the most beautiful designed lamps in the world come from the golden age of Danish design. For example, the lamps of Poul Henningsen, Arne Jacobsen, and Werner Pernten. Visit a student on a shoestring budget, and you may still encounter a 1,000 euro Werner Pernten lamp in the corner of a 32 square meter flat.
What is happiness and how do we achieve it, especially as we now enter the colder months when the days get shorter, nights grow longer, and our mood visibly shifts? Well, maybe we could learn a little bit from our neighbors in Denmark. So joining me today to hopefully offer some advice is Mike Viking. He's the founder and CEO of the Happiness Research Institute, and he's also the author of the worldwide bestsellers, The Little Book of Hygge and The Little Book of Lykke.
Thanks for having me.
The reason we have you here today is because Denmark regularly ranks in the top of the world's happiest countries. So what is the secret? Why did you choose to write a book about this? Was that something that just came to you one day and just struck you and you went like, oh gosh, so many people ask me about it. I might as well write it down so they stop asking.
That's part of it. No, I mean, back in 2012, I was working for a think tank on sustainability. But one late evening in the office, I stumbled upon the World Happiness Report. And Denmark was in first place in that ranking. And I just became curious, you know, why is it that Denmark often does well in these happiness rankings? There should be somebody in Denmark trying to understand that and pooling the knowledge there is. And then I thought, maybe I should do that. I started doing research and were quite aware of the impact of the sort of political, of the Nordic policies of the welfare state. But I also wanted to look at how does the culture impact how Danes feel. And, you know, Danes think that Denmark has a monopoly on hygge. I disagree with that. I think hygge happens just as much in the UK and Canada as it does in Denmark. But what is uniquely Danish is that we believe that hygge is part of the cultural DNA, and we see it perhaps the same way that Americans see freedom as something inherently American. Danes will see hygge as something inherently Danish. And it's something we give a value. If you have guests over, you know, you'll talk to your spouse afterwards. Did you think the guests had a hyggelig time tonight? And we talk about it a lot. So I'll invite you over for dinner. And then, you know, during the week, we'll talk about how hyggelig Friday is going to be. Then on Friday, we'll talk about how hyggelig this is. And then on Monday, we'll talk about how hyggelig Friday was. So it's also something about being consciously cozy and sort of explicitly savoring the simple things in life. But of course, that happens everywhere. But Danes are sort of culturally very aware of that.
The obsession with lighting comes from the lack of contact with it in the natural world from October to March. During this time, the only resource Denmark has in abundance is darkness. Summers in Denmark are beautiful. When the first rays of light reach the country, Danes awaken from their hibernation and fall over themselves to find spots in the sun. I love summer in Denmark. It's my favorite day of the year. And if it wasn't bad enough that winters are dark and cold and summers are short, Denmark also has 179 days of rain per year. Game of Thrones fans, think of the city of Winterfell. That is why hygge has been refined to the level it has, and why it is seen as part of the national identity and culture in Denmark. Hygge is the antidote to the cold winter, the rainy days, and the duvet of darkness. So while you can have hygge all year round, it is during winter that it becomes not only a necessity, but a survival strategy. That is why Danes have a reputation of being hygge fundamentalists and talk about it a lot.
So the book's called The Little Book of Hygge. What else can we find in it? Will we find some tips on how to get that hygge feeling in our house or how to embrace it by us here in the UK?
Yeah, so it's looking at hygge from all different angles. You know, there's even recipes in there. Some food is more hygge than others. There are the different words that are used around hygge. I think there is also a chapter on hygge in the home, because homes are the headquarters of hygge. So sort of all things related to hygge. And it was really fun for me to research and write the book because it's such a big part of my culture and the Danish culture. And then starting to sort of peel the different layers off hygge and seeing how much it actually affects our behavior and how we design our homes. So for instance, I'm pointing towards a lamp now. The way we light our homes is also influenced by hygge. So Danes will prefer a soft, warm light compared to sort of a white, sterile light because it gives a more hyggelig atmosphere. And basically hygge is about creating a nice, warm atmosphere. So everything from interior design to conversations to recipes to hygge indoors and outdoors and throughout the year, that's what we go through in the book.
You work with the Research Institute, you've written this book, and you've actually written a couple more books as well. And I think one specifically about, we mentioned it, it's Lugha, which I think means happiness. Am I correct here?
Correct, yes.
So what can we expect from these other books from you? What would you say they're about? Like, you've talked about Hygge, so how do you expand from there?
So the little book of Lykke, what I wanted to do with that was to show that Denmark doesn't have a monopoly on happiness. And I wanted to see what are people doing right around the world in terms of boosting their mood and their well-being. So what can we learn from Japan? What can we learn from Bhutan? What can we learn from the French in terms of improving quality of life? And I look at the sort of six overall factors that explain why some people are happier than others through the World Happiness Report.
Lykke is the Danish word for happiness, but you may refer to it as felicidad if you are Spanish, or glück, or bonheur if you are German or French. No matter what you call it, story time will light up smiles in classrooms in the same way wherever you are in the world. A couple of years ago, I was skiing with some friends in Italy. We had finished for the day and were enjoying the sun and coffee on the balcony of our cabin. Then somebody realized that we had leftover pizza in the fridge, and I exclaimed, "Is this happiness? I think so." And I wasn't the only one. Despite the fact that my friends on the balcony were from different countries, Denmark, India, and the US, we all felt that sharing food with friends in the soft warmth of a March sun overlooking the beautiful snow-covered mountains was pretty damn close to happiness. We might have been born on different continents, raised in different cultures, schooled in different languages, but we all shared that same feeling that this was happiness.
And then my latest book is called The Art of Making Memories, because I could see that our ability to form a positive narrative about our past also impact how happy we feel right now. And I wanted to see what can we do to become better at retrieving happy memories and creating happy memories. So what can I do that my future self will remember in the future in terms of happy experiences? And it was really, really fun to explore our memory. And for instance, you know, what we can do is we can create first experiences. We are far more likely to remember first experiences than something we've experienced again and again. And it can be something, you know, going to a new place, but it can also be trying out a new dish. So one of the tips in the book, for instance, is creating what I call the Apollo picnic, which is celebrated on July 20th. So what you do is, you know, you ask your friends and family to join you for a picnic on July 20th. And the concept is everybody brings an ingredient they have not tried before or a dish they have not tried before. So it could be boller and kai or Danish herring or habanero chili, which is really, really spicy. And it's also good for memory if we do something that scares us a little bit. So trying out new stuff will be something that can help us remember it in the future. And the reason why you do it on July 20th and call it the Apollo picnic is that that is when the moon landing happened. So the first man on the moon. And our memory works through association. So then sometime in the future when you hear about the moon landing or when you hear about the Apollo missions, that will trigger your memory of that lovely time in July where you had that amazing Danish dish. You know, I really enjoyed understanding that there's actually a lot we can do to influence what we and our family and friends remember in the future. And sort of thinking of yourself as a memory architect that has influence over your own and loved ones' memories. I think that's a powerful position to be in.
How do you ask strangers about memories without sounding all Hannibal Lecter? Tell me about your childhood memories, Clarice. I have also asked and tried to answer these questions as an archaeologist venturing into my own past, searching to retrieve lost treasures in the form of happy memories. I revisited my childhood home, a home the family sold 20 years ago, to discover how the scent of a place could trigger memories. Thank you to the new owners who did not slam the door in my face when I asked, "Can I come in and smell your house?" With this search for lost treasures comes the understanding that our childhood memories are created, shaped, and retrieved in collaboration with our parents. My mother died 2 decades ago, and with her, an entire continent of memories vanished. In that sense, this story is also a search for Atlantis, a quest for memories lost.
And of course, Mike Viking's books, The Little Book of Hygge, The Little Book of Lugge, and The Art of Making Memories are all available through Audible, on CD, and of course on Kindle as well.
And if I can add to that, I narrated my book myself, which was a really, really fun experience. And as you can hear, you know, English is not my first language. I struggle with some sentences, for example, a lot of V's and W's in sequence. If I had to say the Viking warrior review, that's something I struggle with. But it was really, really fun to narrate. Basically, I try to write like imagining sitting across from somebody else, having a nice conversation over a glass of wine. And hopefully the tone of that also goes into the audiobooks.
Thanks to Mike Viking and Paulina. Now it's back to Maud Roll for the books of her life.
Maud, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
So this is a book, The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea by Mishima Yukio. I think, to be honest, the first time I read it, I was a bit too young. It's quite dark, but Mishima's command of language is just exquisite. So it started me on a bit of a trend of reading a lot of Japanese fiction, and ultimately I went on to read Japanese studies at Cambridge as my bachelor's degree. Without reading that book, I would be in a very different place now, I'm sure. But studying a language at university was amazing and really helped me gain a deeper understanding of my own language, and it really has impacted my writing. So I'm really grateful that that journey started with such a fantastic book, which I really do recommend. But maybe not if you're quite young. It really is quite dark. But if you're older, then it's an excellent read.
Sleep well, dear. Noboru's mother closed his bedroom door and locked it. What would she do if there were a fire? Let him out first thing. She had promised herself that. But what if the wooden door warped in the heat, or paint clogged the keyhole? The window? There was a gravel path below. Besides, the second floor of this gangling house was hopelessly high. It was all his own fault. It would never have happened if he hadn't let the chief persuade him to sneak out of the house that night. There had been endless questions afterward, but he hadn't revealed the chief's name.
Chris Courtney narrating The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea by Mishima Yukio, which is available from the RNIB library.
Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Ooh, I'm going to go for The White Book by Han Kang. I just love this book. It's brilliant, and it will always have a special place in my heart, to be honest, because it's the first book I read using the Orcam, which is a device that reads text out loud from paper books. It uses OCR, funnily enough, which I mentioned in my interview earlier, but it will take a picture of essentially a printed book's page and read it out loud to you. And so that was really special, because after I went blind, it was quite difficult learning how to engage with reading again. I felt quite separate from printed books, and that was quite distressing for a little while, but the Orcam changed all that. So it was the first book I read all the way through with that device, and also it was around Christmas time, which is always a nostalgic time of year. So yeah, that book will just always make me happy, and I mean it's quite a sad book, to be honest, but it's beautifully written. I love that the format is such a challenge to the traditional idea of what a novel is supposed to be. It's very fragmented. And Han Kang is a terrifically talented writer. I'm such a big fan. Human Act is also excellent. But yeah, she's brilliant. The book is brilliant. Yeah, I like to think of Christmas time. So that's always nice.
Unfortunately, The White Book by Hang Kang isn't available in audio, but here's a clip from The Vegetarian, also written by Hang Kang, which is available from the RNIB library.
Before my wife turned vegetarian, I'd always thought of her as completely unremarkable in every way. To be frank, the first time I met her, I wasn't even attracted to her. Middling height, bobbed hair neither long nor short, jaundiced, sickly-looking skin, somewhat prominent cheekbones. Her timid, sallow aspect told me all I needed to know. As she came up to the table where I was waiting, I couldn't help but notice her shoes, the plainest black shoes imaginable. And that walk of hers, neither fast nor slow, striding nor mincing.
Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
The book I finished most recently was Paradise Lost, which I never read at school, as I know many people did. And it was actually fantastic. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. John Milton is a terrific writer. The sound of it, just like the way it uses the musicality of the English language, is really stunning. And it's just so epic. It's so cinematic. I mean, there are just incredible scenes with angels throwing mountains at other angels. And it's just, it's really cinematic. And I really hope someone makes like a really decadent CGI version of it on the big screen. I think that would be really cool. But it's also just beautifully, beautifully written. I mean, the poetry is stunning and it's got really compelling characterization. Malcolm X read it in prison, I know, and really empathised with the character of Satan, and it's really easy to see why. The character work is really, really brilliant, and it's really compelling. I actually really enjoyed it. And, of course, John Milton was blind, so it was a nice exploring blind culture. And also the audiobook read by Anton Lesser is really, really excellent. He has a great voice for it.
Oh, for that warning voice which he who saw the apocalypse heard cry in heaven aloud. Then, when the dragon put to second rout came furious down to be revenged on men, woe to the inhabitants on earth. That now, while time was, our first parents had been warned the coming of their secret foe and scaped, haply so scaped his mortal snare. For now, Satan, now first inflamed with rage, came down, the tempter ere the accuser of mankind, to wreak on innocent frail man his loss of that first battle and his flight to hell.
Anton Lesser narrating Paradise Lost by John Milton, which is available from the RNIB library.
Maud Roll, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been so lovely to be here. Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.